show where we share our favorite stories from Boston history. This is episode 53, The Radical Haywoods. Hi, I'm Nikki.
And I'm Jake. This week, we're going to talk about Angela and Ezra Haywood, two writers, activists, free love advocates, suffragists, socialists, labor reformers, and abolitionists who shocked the sensibilities of Victorian Boston. But before we discuss the Haywoods, it's time to take a look at what's coming up this week in Boston history.
Monday is November 6th, and November 6th, 1894 was election day in Boston. It had been a tense election season. After a Wall Street collapse the year before, an economic depression was felt nationwide. In Boston, factories shut down, stores closed up shop, and wages fell drastically. Statewide, the unemployment rate approached 25%, and an army of 5,000 unemployed men took over the State House to demand relief. Against that backdrop, a young man named John F. Fitzgerald campaigned for U.S. Congress in the Massachusetts 9th District. The son of Irish immigrants, Fitzgerald promoted himself as the champion of the downtrodden, the immigrant, and the unemployed, in contrast to the establishment Yankee leaders he ran against. Fitzgerald had been a city councilor and a state senator at that point, and he had the backing of Boston Mayor Martin Lomasny, while powerful Democratic ward boss P.J. Kennedy of East Boston backed another candidate. When Fitzgerald won the Democratic caucus, he faced Republican Randolph Gore in the general election. In the face of labor unrest stirred up by the ongoing recession, fringes of the Republican Party embraced a nativist philosophy that blamed immigrants and Catholics for the country's woes. Playing up this loose affiliation, the master politician Fitzgerald would demand that Gore and other mainstream Republicans denounce the nativists. If they refused, he would treat that as proof that they all agreed with the radical wing of the party. If they agreed, it only served to point out that the radical wing of the party existed. The Irish politician Fitzgerald used this defense of Catholicism to make common ground with his co-religionists among the Italian-American community in Boston. Then, he shrewdly extended his defense to the Jewish communities in the North End and West End. At one rally, he said, "I cannot see how the Jewish people can remain quiet and observe the secret machinations against their fellow citizens. Unless you go forth on Tuesday and throttle this prospective monster, how do you know that the next step will not be against the Jew?" The strategy worked. On election day, John Fitzgerald, who we remember as Honey Fitz, became the first Irish-American congressman from Massachusetts, founding an enduring political dynasty. Biographer Doris Kearns Goodwin repeats a possibly apocryphal story from the morning after the 1894 Democratic caucus. Honey Fitz went to East Boston to meet with defeated ward boss P.J. Kennedy. "Now that the fight is over, P.J., let's shake hands," Fitzgerald said during his early morning visit to P.J. Kennedy's home in East Boston. And they did. But before Fitzgerald left, he spotted P.J.'s sandy-haired, blue-eyed son, who would have been 6 years old at the time. Responding to the child with his customary warmth, Fitzgerald lifted him up onto his lap and gave him a lollipop. If this is true, it's the first recorded meeting between John Fitzgerald and his 4-year-old daughter's future husband, Joseph Patrick Kennedy. Rose Fitzgerald and Joseph Kennedy had a son named John Fitzgerald Kennedy, who would begin his political career a half a century later with a congressional run in the same Massachusetts 9th District, where his grandfather and namesake Honey Fitz began his.
On the evening of November 7, 1916, car 393 of the Boston Elevated Railway Company made its way through South Boston, picking up factory workers at the shift change. By the time the car crossed the Reserve Shipping Channel, it was completely packed. At the Fish Pier, they picked up some 20 more passengers, while in the distance ahead, the drawtenders at the Summer Street Drawbridge heard the steam whistle from a tugboat that indicated that it was time to open the bridge. The tenders went out to set red lamps and warning gates on each end of the bridge as keeper Timothy Shea began to open the sliding center span. As the streetcar was running behind schedule, motorman Gerald Walsh pushed the speed up to 10 or even 15 miles an hour in an attempt to make up time. 200 feet before the bridge, there was a stop sign suspended above the track. There would be a great dispute later about whether Walsh saw the sign, which the Globe described as a stop sign, about 17 inches long and 4.5 inches wide, with letters 2 by 3 inches. Suspended to a span of wire 30 feet above the rail, is located 175 east of the gates and 200 feet from the draw opening. And according to the rules of the company, the motorman must bring his car to a full stop before passing such a sign. Whether he saw it or not, Walsh acknowledged that he didn't bring the car to a complete stop. Instead, he slowed to a crawl while yet another passenger hopped on, then accelerated again. At this point, there were about 70 people on board. Walsh didn't see the warning gates on the open bridge until car 393 was practically on top of them. He yanked the brake lever so hard that he bent it and threw the electric motor into reverse. However, it was quickly clear that it was too late to stop. As the car slid toward the open span, he yelled out, "Jump!" The people at the front of the car could see the terrible gap in the bridge in front of them and heeded Walsh's call to jump, but few in the back knew what was happening. With no time to lose, Walsh too jumped from the car. Coming to the edge, the streetcar teetered for a moment, then tipped off. It fell about 20 feet to the water, hitting a wooden beam along the way. Then, at 5:26 p.m., it sank in 30 feet of water, with the tide coming in. The bridge workers and tugboat crew managed to rescue a few people who had been thrown free as the car went into the water, and a scant handful who managed to swim out of the submerged car. Fire and police personnel converged on the scene, and Mayor James Michael Curley called the Charlestown Navy Yard to request boats and divers. Precious time passed as firefighters with grappling hooks searched for those trapped below. Finally, at 6:45, the first body was pulled up, and at 7:15, they located the wrecked trolley on the floor of the channel. Just after 1 a.m., the last body was recovered. In all, 47 Bostonians were killed. The accident caused the Boston Elevated Railway to standardize signs, gates, and braking procedures at all the city's drawbridges and other hazardous crossings. Motorman Walsh was charged with manslaughter and acquitted. The Summer Street Bridge disaster would be the deadliest event for a generation in Boston, until it was finally surpassed by the terrible Coconut Grove fire in 1942.
Wednesday is November 8th. James Mason and John Slidell were so-called diplomats employed by the Confederate States of America. So-called because only nation-states can have diplomats, and the Confederacy was an illegitimate state. Confederate President Jefferson Davis had sent Mason and Slidell on a mission to seek diplomatic recognition for the breakaway region in France and England. Because the United States was blockading the main ports off the southern region, Mason and Slidell had to slip out of Charleston Harbor in a small blockade runner. They proceeded to the Bahamas and then on to Cuba, where they boarded the British mail packet RMS Trent. Learning of their plan, U.S. Navy Captain Charles Wilkes pursued the Trent aboard his ship, the San Jacinto. On November 8, 1861, the San Jacinto caught up to the Trent in the narrow deepwater channel between the Bahamas and Cuba. Wilkes fired warning shots across the bow of the Trent and ordered his men to board the British ship. Since Britain was neutral in the U.S. Civil War, this could have been seen as an act of war against a neutral country and sparked an international incident that almost brought England into the war on the Confederate side. Nevertheless, Mason and Slidell were captured. They were brought to Boston Harbor and held at Fort Warren alongside hundreds of other Confederate civilian and military prisoners. If you'd like to learn more about the role of Fort Warren as a prison camp during the Civil War, check out episode 51.
By early November 1775, the Siege of Boston had been going on for over half a year. The British troops who occupied Boston were supplied with powder and food by sea, but it was never enough to fill their hungry bellies. The Continental forces cut them off from resupply by land, so they scavenged where they could. In past episodes, we heard about skirmishes on the Boston Harbor Islands as British raiding parties attempted to seize hay and livestock. On November 9, 1775, a party of up to 400 British regulars in 20 boats took advantage of an abnormally high tide to try and steal some cows and sheep from an isolated farm in Cambridge. The area known as Leechmere's Point, now roughly the location of the Cambridge Side Galleria, had a handful of Continental soldiers standing sentinel duty. But this unusually high tide turned the peninsula into an island. The British were able to quickly subdue the sentries, who were now cut off from reinforcement, while artillery from British batteries in Charlestown and the North End fired to deter a counterattack. The firing raised the alarm in the Continental camp. Colonel William Thompson's battalion of Pennsylvania riflemen was chosen to push the British raid back. A counterattack would mean marching the men across the flooded fields through several feet of ice-cold water, completely exposed to the British batteries. The Philadelphia Evening Post reported that Colonel Thompson marched instantly with his men, and though a very stormy day, they regarded not the tide nor waited for boats, but took to the water, although up to their armpits, for a quarter of a mile, and notwithstanding the regulars' fire, reached the island, and although the enemy were lodged behind walls and under cover, drove them to their boats. Loss, 1 killed and 3 wounded. British loss, 17 killed and 1 wounded. There are conflicting reports on the number of casualties from other sources, but almost all put the number lower than that news report. Some say 1 American killed and 1 captured, some say 2 wounded, and many say that 2 British regulars were killed, and that the regulars made off with about 10 head of cattle.
Friday is November 10th, and the diary of John Adams records what humor was like in the 18th century in an entry on November 10th, 1771. Adams was traveling through eastern Massachusetts as an attorney of the circuit court and had just concluded a week in court at Salem. On the 10th, he dined with Joseph Putnam and his son, Colonel Israel Putnam, who was visiting from Connecticut. The colonel, who in 4 years would become a Continental general and hero of Bunker Hill, told John Adams the story of an Indian upon Connecticut River who had called at a tavern in the fall of the year for a dram, meaning a drink of rum. The landlord asked him for 2 coppers for it. The next spring, happening at the same house, he called for another and had 3 coppers to pay for it. "How is this, landlord?" says he. "Last fall you asked for 2 coppers for a glass of rum, now you ask for 3. "Oh," says the landlord, "it costs me a good deal to keep rum over the winter. It is as expensive to keep a hogshead of rum over the winter as a horse." "Aye," says the Indian, "I can see through that. He won't eat so much hay. Maybe he drink as much water." Get it? He was saying that the landlord was charging more for watered-down rum. It may not seem like much of a joke to you, but it was apparently the pinnacle of comedy in 1771. John Adams described it as sheer wit, pure satire, and true humor in one very short repartee.
The persistent myth of wilderness in America makes us all susceptible to the idea that anyone who arrived on our shores could make a life for themselves if they just put their mind to it. On the endless frontier, you could hack out a clearing with an axe, a shovel, and your own 2 hands, and no man could stop you. A note from the very early history of New England reminds us that even at the very beginning, not everyone was welcome in Massachusetts Bay Colony. November 11th, 1630. The master of the ship Handmaid comes to Boston with Captain Standish, meaning Miles Standish of Plymouth, and 2 gentlemen passengers who came to plant here. But having no testimonials, we would not receive them. There's no word on where the 2 gentlemen ended up, but they did not become freeholders at Boston.
Finally, Sunday is November 12th, which marks a fun anniversary for Boston from the year 1928. Pioneering aviator Amelia Earhart, the reigning queen of the skies, was making a promotional tour of her adopted hometown. She had completed a history-making flight earlier that summer, becoming the first woman to fly across the Atlantic Ocean. Or, rather, be flown, as she was a passenger, and a man named Wilmer Stultz was the pilot. She would say that, "I was just baggage, like a sack of potatoes." But it did provide inspiration for her 1932 solo flight across the Atlantic, the first by a woman. During her visit to Boston in 1928, Earhart went back to the spot where her career in aviation began, Denison House in the South Cove neighborhood, visiting on November 12th. Denison House was a settlement house that was unique at the time for being operated entirely by women in partnership with Wellesley College. It provided education and social services for the poor of the neighborhood, who were mostly immigrants from around the world, with the goal of increasing class mobility for them. Amelia Earhart arrived in Boston in 1924 with a pilot's license, a bright yellow Kissel Speedster Roadster, and a dream of one day studying at MIT. She soon found work at Denison House, first as a teacher, and then later as a social worker. By 1926, she had moved into the house to be able to devote more time to her work there. She would be recognized at a national conference of settlement houses as one of the most promising social workers of her generation. But on the weekends, she kept flying biplanes out of the rough airfield that would eventually become Squantum Point Naval Air Station. Sometimes, she could even combine her passions by flying over Boston and Cambridge to drop flyers for upcoming Denison House events. In 1928, George Palmer Putnam and Captain Hilton Raley were looking for a woman, a special woman, who could take the starring role in the expedition they were promoting, to fly a woman across the Atlantic Ocean for the first time. Amy Guest, a Steele Harris who was funding the flight, had recently declined to take the seat of honor herself. Looking for a replacement, Raley called an acquaintance who flew planes out of Boston, Rear Admiral Reginald Belknap. Belknap thought he knew just the right sort of girl. The vice president of the Boston chapter of the American Aeronautical Society was a young social worker who flies, adding that she was a thoroughly fine person. Call Denison House and ask for Amelia Earhart. That phone call would steer Earhart away from a life in settlement houses and social work and toward worldwide fame. She would be the first woman across the Atlantic, then the first person to fly across the Atlantic twice after her 1932 solo flight. She was the first woman to fly solo across the United States, and the first to fly from Hawaii to the mainland. She set women's speed and altitude records. And in 1937, she achieved lasting fame when her plane disappeared over the South Pacific in an attempt to become the first woman to fly around the world, and the first person to fly the equatorial route around the world.
Now let's turn to our main topic, Angela and Ezra Haywood. For a little background, we covered the Watch and Ward Society, Boston's powerful and quasi-governmental censorship committee, in episode 40. Originally the New England Society for the Suppression of Vice, the society was founded in 1878 in response to a speech given by Anthony Comstock. Comstock had founded the New York Society for Suppression of Vice in 1873 as a vehicle to crusade against numerous perceived ills of society. Later that year, Comstock successfully influenced Congress to pass the Comstock Law, which made illegal the delivery by U.S. mail, or by other modes of transportation, obscene, lewd, or lascivious material, as well as prohibiting any methods of production or publication of information pertaining to the procurement of abortion, the prevention of conception, and the prevention of venereal disease. Divisive in his day, his law was embraced by religious groups, while those in favor of civil liberties continually tested the law and staged public protests. When discussing the lives and deeds of Angela and Ezra Haywood, it's important to keep this context in mind. Angela Haywood was born in Deerfield, New Hampshire around 1840 to Daniel and Lucy Tilton. Her father was a farmer and her mother was a radical thinker who was descended from John Locke, who, for all you non-philosophy majors out there, is known as the father of liberalism. The Tilton women would have made Locke proud. Lucy taught all six of her children sex education from an early age, encouraging them not to use euphemisms or to be secretive about sex. She also taught her children to trust common sense and common people. Lucy considered formal education to be a waste of time compared to the richness of experience. As Angela once explained, "Mother Tilton admonished us children, and all others she taught, never to defer to doctors, lawyers, or clergymen, but meet them simply as persons. Never to bow lower or curtsy quicker to educated than to unbookish people."
When the family fell into poverty, Angela earned money as a housemaid for Reverend John Prince, and later as a caregiver to the child of Reverend Charles J. Bowen in Newburyport. This work gave her a perspective on wage labor, which would influence her later views on labor reform. Though she had little formal education, Angela was politically conscious and joined the abolitionist movement. Through this activism, she met Ezra Haywood, a fellow abolitionist and a labor reformer. Ezra had a very different upbringing. He came from a respectable Massachusetts family and followed the trajectory of many a privileged, morally upright 19th century New Englander. He entered Brown University to become a Christian minister. But then he had an experience all too common on college campuses. He met people who were different from him. People from different backgrounds, with different experiences and ideas. He met women who were suffragists and befriended abolitionists. And so, a radical was born. They say there's a lid for every pot, and these two radicals were perfectly matched. They were married in Old South Church on June 5, 1865, and moved to the town of Princeton, Massachusetts, where they bought a large house from which they would eventually run a publishing business, the Cooperative Publishing Company. Between May of 1872 and April of 1893, Angela and Ezra worked together to publish The Word, a monthly journal of reform, known for blunt discussion of taboo subjects. The Word catered to many different movements, including free love, women's suffrage, socialism, and labor reform. It published a variety of works, such as essays, editorials, and book reviews. Angela was a frequent writer for The Word. She contributed on a variety of topics, but was most well known for her writings on sexuality. She believed that there were specific moral codes that men and women should follow. This especially applied to men, who she believed should be obligated to control their sexual desires and take responsibility for their actions. This meant, among other things, that they should acknowledge their illegitimate children rather than leaving the children and their mothers to be stigmatized by society. Angela believed women needed to realize that they, too, were allowed to derive pleasure from sex. In some ways, however, Angela did subscribe to the gender stereotypes of the time. Even though she believed that women could feel sexual passion, she did not think it was in their nature to consider the possibility of sex without love, whereas men were more likely to do this. In addition to her writings about sex, Haywood championed women's suffrage and wrote passionate arguments against rape. She was a labor reformer and believed wealthy women to be morally corrupt because they did not work. She ardently defended prostitutes, blaming their poverty and desperation on the men who exploited them.
It would be an understatement to say that The Word did not go over well with Comstock and his pearl-clutching followers. On November 2, 1877, he appeared at a Boston meeting of the Free Love Society and arrested Ezra for mailing obscene literature. In June of 1878, Haywood was convicted and sentenced to 2 years of hard labor in a Dedham jail. Ezra would go on to be arrested 4 more times and jailed once more. And it's worth noting that Angela never paid the same price for her role in the business, a fact that she was actually quite vexed by, as she considered the double standard to be quite sexist. Not all readers of The Word were fans of Angela's work, and many blamed her for Ezra's 1877 arrest. It is true that she was quite controversial, even for a liberal publication. She spoke plainly, and she refused to use euphemisms when discussing matters of sex and the body. For those who read The Word for abolition, suffrage, or labor reform pieces, she was just too much. The September 1892 issue reprinted a letter to Angela from reader Laura C. Eldridge, who expressed a common sentiment. "You foul-mouthed, disgusting thing. You ought to be tied to a whipping post until you promise to use decent language. Your demented old idiot of a husband isn't half so much to blame as you are. I think he would be half decent if it wasn't for you. Of course Haywood will go to prison where he ought to go, only you ought to be there too, and put in close confinement where you couldn't contaminate the rest of the felons with your dirty tongue. You nasty brute, you vilest thing in the country. Your children ought to be taken away from you and very likely will be." In The Word, Ezra commented at length on the swelling backlash against his wife. Mr. Waite elsewhere gives one main reason why we got 2 years in Dedham jail. Viz., because the woman in the case, Angela, spoke plainly in Boston, Worcester, and elsewhere on the bodily relations of the sexes, even in a state of nudity. Angela was fiercely assailed by court officers, religio-political magnates, and cultured exponents of propriety. Quoted by Comstock before congressional committees, and in an affidavit letter to President Hayes. All to show, first, that we must be imprisoned, and afterwards, that we must not be released, lest we might again hold free love conventions in which Mrs. Haywood was the provoking, but always popularly interesting and instructive speaker. Angela wrote prolifically, and was often angry at Ezra for editing her essays and cutting out what she felt were important parts, though he never censored her strong language. Despite Angela's massive contributions to the Word, however, only Ezra was ever credited as editor, except for his 6-month stint in jail in 1878, when Benjamin Tucker took over as his substitute. However, Angela was always considered to be the unofficial co-editor.
Ezra was sentenced to jail in June of 1878, and on August 1st, several thousand free speech and free press advocates held an indignation meeting at Faneuil Hall, organized by the National Liberal League. The following account appeared in the Boston newspapers the next day. Free speech. Great meeting in Faneuil Hall. An indignation meeting was held at Faneuil Hall last evening, to which all friends of free speech, irrespective of sect or party, were invited to protest against the injury done to the freedom of the press by the conviction and imprisonment of Ezra Haywood. The readers of the Globe will doubtless remember this particular case, where the prisoner was found guilty and sentenced to 2 years imprisonment in Dedham Jail and made to pay a fine of $100 for sending the pamphlet Cupid's Yokes through the mails. Mr. Haywood has protested against what he calls his illegal imprisonment and refers to the martyrdom of Jesus, Socrates, and John Brown as cases parallel to his own. The galleries were crowded with ladies, who manifested the utmost enthusiasm whenever Mr. Haywood and his sufferings were commented upon. It may have been fancy, it may have been the effect of light and shade, or it may not have happened at all, but we did imagine that we could see the nose and upper lip of the bust of Samuel Adams curl with scorn as he looked rather impatiently upon the large assembly which had met to express indignation at a 2 years' term of imprisonment. As if he wanted to call attention to the fact that all the noble army of martyrs whom Mr. Haywood quotes in his writings had received rougher treatment than imprisonment in Dedham Jail, and not one single meeting of indignation had been held about it. The rest of the busts appeared to be calmly, we might say, stonily ambivalent. Biographer Martin Blatt emphasizes that this was not a rally for free love. The meeting was principally about Haywood's right to express himself. A few, did talk about his radical views on women's rights and sexuality. Most did not. The demonstration prompted President Rutherford B. Hayes to pardon Haywood after he had served 6 months.
This brush with the law did not slow the Haywoods down. Stephen Pearl Andrews, a fellow individualist anarchist and fellow free love advocate, describes Angela as a woman who would not back down under threat of the law or public criticism. She is utterly destitute of the sense of fear. She laughs and rollicks over what seems to the onlooker the edge of a fearful precipice. She would sooner see her beautiful home ruthlessly sacked, her children scattered, herself driven as a drudge into somebody else's kitchen, than she would back down an inch from her full claim to the right to say her full thought in her own words. Louise Michel is no more heroic than she is. She is vexed and annoyed to the last degree that it is Mr. H. who is attacked and not herself. He and she are far more comrades in a common cause, where he annoys her by being in the front, than they are the ordinary husband and wife. She threatens that if he gets in prison again, she will never so much as visit him there, as she will not have it understood that she is a mere wife following the fate of her husband, instead of a free individual fighting her own battles. It is not all, however, that she courts or even believes in martyrdom, but simply that she is willing to take the consequences of her own acts. Folks must not mistake Mrs. Haywood for any weakling. Womanly, ladylike, prepossessing, and eminently domestic, she is yet hard as a flint when her rights, or the rights of those whom she represents, are invaded. She provides elegant parlor accommodations for her boarders, for the reformers, or for other lady visitors, yet keeps herself secluded in the basement, doing more work than three ordinary women, and training her children in the most laborious, painstaking, housewifely, and artistic way. At the same time, her children excel all the children in town in learning, in demeanor, and in a certain reserved and distinguished bearing. They are welcome guests at all the neighboring houses, but seldom go. Mrs. Haywood herself is far less excluded from the Society of Ladies of Princeton. She is a riddle to them. They cite her beautiful household, her children at the head of the schools and public exhibitions, their deportment, the chasteness and elegance of their dress, etc. Some of them have the logic to quote the old book, that we do not gather grapes from thorns, nor figs from thistles, and to conclude that Mrs. Haywood can be no other, after all, than a very good woman. It would seem that Angela was able to speak her mind while also keeping a comfortable home and raising decent children. While fervent advocates of birth control and abortion, the Haywoods had four children together, named Psyche, Angelo, Vesta, and Hermes. To them, it was a matter of choice. They believed that the decision to have children is the business only of the couple, and that every person should have access to the tools and information they need to make an informed choice.
Similarly, they saw free love not as a life of polyamory, but as the fundamental choice of when, where, and how to engage in guilt-free and consensual sexual relations. As equals, Ezra and Angela enjoyed a long-term, committed, monogamous relationship. However, Ezra wrote and distributed a series of pamphlets entitled Cupid's Yokes, which condemned the institution of marriage as akin to slavery for women. He argued that because women were powerless in society, they had little choice but to take a husband. He opens with this observation. When a man says of a woman, "She suits me," that is, she would be to him a serviceable mate, he does not often as seriously ask if he is as likely to suit her. Still less, if this proposed union may not become an ugly domestic knot, which the best interests of both will require to be untied. Furthermore, he argues that marriage is simply an institution to control human sexual urges, based on the notion that premarital sex is sinful. Marriage, in its historical forms, is a human device to tame, utilize, and control sexual passion, which is supposed to be naturally ferocious and ungovernable. What nature hath joined, man need not attempt to put asunder. But since the legalized marital relation is so chaotic and mischievous, clergymen and legislatures are often being the first to violate what they profusely assume to be a divine ordinance, and since deity has never yet come forward to own that he is the author and finisher of marriage laws, it is better to attribute them to the erring men who enacted them than to accuse divine wisdom of so much folly. Marriage, then being the creation of men's laws, we have the same right to alter or abolish it that we have respecting any other human institution. The principles of nature, derived from a careful study of essential liberty and equity, are a safer guide than crude social codes which come to us from the crude and despotic past.
However, Ezra does concede that, from time to time, a wife could have the more ferocious appetite on account of her political, social, and pecuniary vassalage. Woman is the chief martyr to the relentless license granted man. But cases are on record where the husband was effectually subdued by the tigress with whom he went into the nuptial paradise. We could keep going. There are a lot of great passages, but we'll leave it at that and include a link in the show notes. If the idea that marriage is akin to legalized prostitution or slavery sounds ridiculous to you, give it a read, and consider whether there is merit to his points at a time when women had no political power and most had no public life outside the home. Unfortunately, the Haywoods' lack of money meant that Angela had to spend much of her time at home doing housework, and had little time left over to write. She could not attend many conferences because she had to take care of the children. At one point, Ezra published a plea for funds in an issue of The Word, writing, "ATH needs money to liberate herself from too much housework, so she can give more time to writing. Will not financially able men and sympathetic women help her articulate by pouring in cash?" The Word actually ceased publication between 1890 and 1892, when Ezra was in prison for the second time, and Angela didn't have time to run it herself. Arrested a fifth and final time for distributing a pamphlet on abortion and birth control written by Angela, he would serve a full 2-year term in the Charlestown State Prison. He contracted tuberculosis while in prison and died in May of 1893. The Word ceased publication permanently after Ezra's death, and little is known about the rest of Angela's life, though we know she died at the age of 95 in 1935.
NJS is also in need of funds to liberate herself from housework and to build a recording studio for podcasting. Please send post-haste. To learn more about the Haywoods, check out this week's show notes at hubhistory.com/053. We'll have the full text of Cupid's Yokes, a feature on Ezra from WGBH, and a link to his biography by Martin Blatt. We'll also link to Ezra's essay, Uncivil Liberty, an essay to show the injustice and impolicy of ruling women without her consent. And, of course, we'll have links and sources for all of this week's historical anniversaries. We have something new this week, a correction. On last week's anniversary episode, we talked about an incident of voter fraud in Puritan Massachusetts, where a man named McGill Smith cast 3 votes in the form of kidney beans for the same candidate. That was our historical anniversary for November 2nd, and we must have gotten our notes mixed up when preparing the script, because that fraudulent vote actually took place on May 26th, 1647. We'll put a link in this week's show notes with some more information.
If you want to get in touch with us, you can email us at podcast@hubhistory.com. We're Hub History on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Or you can go to hubhistory.com and click on the Contact Us link. While you're on the site, hit the subscribe link and be sure that you never miss an episode. If you subscribe on Apple Podcasts, please think about writing us a brief review. It's still the best way to help others discover the show.
That's all for now. We'll be back next time with an episode on the impressment riots.